Good evening, everyone. I would like to call the study session of the University City City Council to order on May 10th, 2021. Prior to turning the program over to the city manager, I believe there may be a couple of changes to tonight's regular meeting agenda. Am I correct, Mr. Rose?
Honorable Mayor, I have one change that I will propose. That is moving item H3 to the city manager's report and making it I3.
Okay. Thank you. I'm sure one of my colleagues will be willing to make that motion when the agenda comes forward. Are there any other questions from members of council? Mr. Clay? No? Okay. Thank you. All right, moving forward, Mr. Rose.
Honorable Mayor, council members, the Army Corps of Engineers continue to advance the River to Pear project. And tonight, I believe they are here to present provide you with an update as well as get your input on the progress that they are making. So I will turn it over to Janet. Are you doing the presentation? Okay.
Yes, thank you so much, Mr. Rose. Mr. Mayor, City Council members, thank you for having us back. My name is Janet Buchanan. I am the plan formulator on the study. And we also have on the call tonight a few other technical experts. So hopefully we can answer all of your questions as they come up. So we've got Mr. Matt Jones, who's the project manager, Sean Sullivan, strategic planning coordinator, Joel Asunskis is the hydraulics and hydrology H&H engineer, Jordan Lucas is the economist on the study, and I'm hoping that Monique Savage will also be able to join. She is the senior plan formulator at the district. So I'm going to go ahead and pull up the slides as I start talking here. Let's see. Okay. All right. So we are here tonight, of course, to provide a detailed update on our progress in the study, answer your questions, identify concerns and risks, and determine our path forward as we get to our major TSP milestone. The TSP stands for the tentatively selected plan, and that is the plan that we will move forward with to formulate in more detail as the study moves forward. So in the presentation tonight, I will quickly go through some of the alternatives that were examined to select the TSP from, and then I'll do that pretty quickly so that we have a lot of time for feedback and questions at the last, hopefully more than half of the meeting will be open for questions. I did want to note that since the last time we presented to the City Council in March, we've held several technical team meetings, and pretty much every week we've had attendance from folks on the Commission on Stormwater Issues, so we thank them for attending, and hopefully the process has become a little clearer to them. And also from MSD, Mr. Jeffrey B. attended. So that has been very helpful coordination. And last Tuesday, we presented the same set of slides to the Commission on Stormwater Issues, and they identified several questions and concerns. So I will try to address some of the answers to those as I go through tonight. Okay. So with these slides, these are the same set that we are planning to present to our Corps of Engineers senior leadership for that TSP milestone. So this is an abridged version of those slides. You're seeing the same thing that they will. For the study overview, I'll go very quickly. As you know, it's a study to reevaluate the flooding problems and potential plans to reduce flood risk for the upper River de Pere in University City. Goals and objectives focus around reducing life safety risk and reducing economic damage due to flooding. The study schedule, we are just over a year into the study here in May 2021, and our next major step after this meeting is releasing a draft report to the public with the TSP and what's planned, and then a public meeting also in July 2021. The plan formulation process, this is just sort of a summary of how we went about identifying various measures that would help address flood risk, including from expertise and from the planning charrette held last year. And then we screened down, taking out about five measures for various reasons on the next slide, and then developed 10 alternatives, and finally whittled down to six alternatives in the final array. And a very important note here is we're not expecting to be at a high level of design for these alternatives. Part of the Corps of Engineers planning process is we get to about 10% level of design for this stage, just so that we can compare evenly across all alternatives before investing too heavily in any of them and, you know, spending too much time and money on one that might not pan out to be the most effective or cost effective. So that's the plan at this stage. We explored several measures, 15 measures, including structural, non-structural, and nature-based. I'll go on ahead. Okay, these are the five that we screened out, including modifying the tubes, diverting the river itself, dry floodproofing with active measures in areas with a very low warning time, relocation of structures, mostly because there's not much space to move them away, and wetlands restoration. We reevaluated the recommendations in the 1988 feasibility report as a key part of the study, the reevaluation study, and found that the channel and bridge modifications that were part of the U12 measure for University City were not effective as a standalone measure. So while they did decrease flood impacts sort of in the upstream area of the University City watershed, they caused downstream impacts at the tubes, and on their own, they did not address that induced flooding. So that table here shows the increased flow and stage at the tubes. And there were other features in the plan that were acceptable, but without the channel modification, it was not a holistic solution. So what you'll see in the alternatives when I get there is we do look at what would fixing this alternative look like, what could we add to make it a complete alternative, and we added detention basins to do that, so I'll get to that in a minute. These are the six measures that are the major ones developed into alternatives in the final array. So for structural, we've got detention basins, levees and flood walls, channel and bridge modification, and the non-structural elements are elevation of structures, floodproofing, and acquisition. And then I also wanted to note the other features included sort of evenly across all the alternatives. So the flood warning system would be included in all of the alternatives. Risk communication, education, and natural and nature-based were also being considered. This is our summary table of the final array of alternatives and which measures are included in each one. So you've got no action is the number one, which we compare all of the plans against. And then the authorized plan with modifications, with the detention basins as the modification. And I should mention that the authorized plan, that's the plan from the 1988 study featuring channel and bridge modification. Yes, channel and bridge modifications. Number 3A and 3B, those are detention basin based alternatives. We'll get to those in a moment. A levee and flood wall alternative. And then 5 and 6 are non-structural, featuring only acquisition of structures. And 6 is a non-structural alternative with other types of measures, but not acquisition. So the way that we evaluate the alternatives kind of goes into four main categories or accounts. The major one, the most important one to the federal government on sort of the national scale, is the National Economic Development or NED account. And that takes into account flood damage in the community, all of the costs that go into construction or real estate or other items associated with making the alternative happen. It looks at the economic consequences of the alternatives and implementation components as well. Okay, Then the other three, very quickly, are regional economic development, or RED, which looks at regional economic impacts, including labor and employment. Environmental quality, or EQ, which looks at impacts to threatened and endangered species, wetlands, hazardous toxic radioactive waste impacts, and also cultural resources such as historic structures. And last but not least, other social effects captures anything else that was not captured in the other three accounts, which includes, very importantly, life safety risk, critical infrastructure protected, socioeconomic consequences among the alternatives, and recreation. All right, so now I have a few slides with some images, really getting into the details on the alternatives in the final array. So the authorized plan, as I mentioned, consists of channel and bridge modifications. In the map, it might be a little hard to see, but the red and orange along the river, those are the channel modifications with bridge alterations where bridges occur. And then the modifications that were added to address that downstream increased flow, those are the two detention basins that are outlined in bright green. And we'll get more into detail on those as a standalone in a moment. So we look at three main cost and benefit numbers for each alternative. So the total cost is an important one. How much would it cost to construct, with a lot of other things thrown in, including real estate and interest during construction, all kinds of things. The second one is net annual benefits. So what we do is annualize the costs. So what would the cost be over the 50-year project period? Then we look at the benefits, which include how much would the flood risk reduction reduce damage to homes and structures? And so that goes into the benefit, and that's annualized as well over the whole period. And then the annual costs are subtracted. I'm sorry, the benefits are subtracted from the costs to get the net annual benefits. And lastly, the BCR, the benefit to cost ratio, we divide the benefits by the costs to see if it is above or below one. And the higher the ratio, the more benefit there is. So for this alternative, you can see there are positive net annual benefits and a BCR of over one, which is good. It's good that that means there is, you know, there would be federal interest maybe in exploring this further, but you'll see that the other alternatives have a lot higher benefits. So we are looking at the cost of this and saying the net annual benefits are going to be higher with another alternative or three or four. And so it's not likely that this would be our tentatively selected plan. Okay, so looking at the detention basins on their own, we looked at five locations to begin, and the downstream areas had less hydraulic benefit. And so the upstream locations of detention basin 3 and 4 that you see in the image were more hydraulically feasible. And so just a couple more notes on the design of these. They would be dry detention for maximum storage during storms. So they would be dry until they're needed, essentially. And they could have recreation and naturalized features added to them as well. For option 3A, we looked at detention basin 3 and 4 together, which would have a total cost of $45 million, net annual benefits of $724,000, and that was the third highest net annual benefit that we saw, and a BCR of 1.33. And for DB4 on its own, the total cost was $9 million. The net annual benefits were $1.2 million, which was the second highest net annual benefit. And the benefit to cost ratio was the highest one at 2.98. There are some risks and uncertainty with detention basins, as with all the alternatives, but some of the big ones are DB4 is located in the city of Overland, so we would need coordination on constructing a basin there. That's in one of their park areas. And also the compatible recreation features is still a bit of a question mark as to what would work with the final design. For the levee and flood wall alternative, we had started by looking at several reaches, and I think at the last city council meeting, we showed you 6 reaches, which was a lot throughout the city. It looked sort of very intimidating, I think, just a lot of levee. But when we looked further at the various constraints, only one of those reaches made it into the final alternative. So, and in fact, it would have been just a flood wall as the major component. Various design features to tie into high ground. It would have impacted those FEMA HMGP lands along Wilson Avenue. So there were other issues there too. And of course, you can see the key numbers there. The net annual benefits were -$1 million and the BCR was -1. And so we are going to move on from that one today, assuming that the benefit is just not there. Okay. For the non-structural acquisition alternative, our economist looked at 3 sets of aggregations of structures. So basically starting with 3 storm events or 3 flood events, the 25-year, the 50-year, and the 75-year, and found at the depth of flooding at those events and the structure inventory from the National Structure Inventory database for those events, that the 25-year event aggregation had the most net annual benefit. I'm skipping ahead of myself. This is the acquisition. But anyway, so he looked at that and it did have the most, but the total net annual benefits for this one were -$4 million. So this acquisition alternative did not come out anywhere close to on top. In fact, it was the worst one. We received a question from the Stormwater Commission last week about why the benefits were so low, or rather why the costs were so high to acquire the structures. So looking at the cost per structure for these 500 structures, it would have come out at about $500,000 per structure. And so, of course, that sounds like a lot for these structures. But we looked back at the cost information, and it is a mixture of things. Some of the structures are commercial rather than residential and have a higher value. And they also include relocation costs and other types of costs that are rolled into that number. Okay. Now we get to the last and perhaps most important for tonight, alternative. Alternative number 6 is a non-structural alternative, featuring floodproofing and elevation of structures. It also looked at 500 residential structures in the 4% AEP, or as we know it, the 25-year floodplain. Most of those 500 in this analysis would be floodproofed, and about 7 would be elevated. The height of elevation that those structures would be raised to or floodproofed to would be the 100-year flood event. For the analysis, at this point, 100% participation was assumed. So any of those structures in the 25-year area assumed to participate. So we know that's an uncertainty. That's not likely to be the case if that moved forward. And then no acquisition was included, even though that was an option for this alternative. What that means is for each structure that the economist viewed, the cost to floodproof or elevate was less than the cost to acquire for the same benefit. So here you can see the total cost is $56 million. The net annual benefits is $2 million, which is the highest, and that's the most important value that we care about for selecting the TSP. And the BCR was the second highest at 2.09. So as I mentioned, the risks and uncertainty moving forward with this one, which we would work to reduce the uncertainty, reduce the risk. The first one is the participation rate. We know that not everyone will voluntarily decide to go to have their home floodproofed or elevated, even if the cost is covered. Participation from the city of Overland is still a question. There are some structures that are upstream of University City. There are impacts to cultural resources, so those historic structures that are in University City Subdivision Number 1, for example. There's a cluster of those that will be affected. I've written optimizing risk level, maybe smaller than the 25-year. So in the next stage, if we move forward with this one, what it means is the economist will look at different storm events, more than just the 25, 50, and 75, to try to find the event that has the greatest net benefits. So it could be, you know, the 10-year, it could be the 5-year, just to try and get to that sweet spot of the most net benefit. Floodproofing type is still a big question. And at this stage, it's not possible for us to say which structures would be treated with which type of floodproofing. And I'll get to a couple of examples of what types those might be in the next couple of slides. But still things to work through on that. And then finally, we are aware that it's important to the city and to residents that FEMA floodproofing FEMA flood insurance premiums are a key component of people making decisions on whether they want to do any of these types of non-structural change. Okay, so just a few slides on types of floodproofing and other non-structural changes. So these are some images of dry floodproofing. Most likely any active measures that you would need to put in place by hand, such as you see here around the doors, most likely those are not going to be acceptable because of the low warning time. But there are some, as in the bottom left, that are activated by the flood water itself, pushing them up. So that is definitely still on the table. For wet floodproofing, this is an example of a historic structure where flood vents were installed in the wall to allow water in to the lower level and to equalize the hydrostatic pressure to make the structure safe during the flood. Thirdly here, I know this is an animated slide. So in buildings where there is wet floodproofing done, it can be in a residential building. The utilities would need to be raised, whether on the interior or exterior. And in most cases, the basement would be filled or reduced use to reduce the overall risk. Okay, there we go. And a quick slide on flood risk. We were able to speak with Karen McHugh at the State Emergency Management Agency earlier today, a little bit about the flood insurance question from FEMA and SEMA's point of view. So the general rule, of course, being that elevation is the best way to reduce risk over the long term. Okay, very quickly, the flood warning system that the commission has been working on, we've received some good detail on that and everything looks good from our point of view. We're happy to incorporate that into any alternative to move forward as a part of any of the plans. Okay, an alternative comparison table. This is just a summary of the numbers that were in the previous slides with a key column here in yellow about the level of risk reduction. So the alternatives are not all addressing the same level of or same size of event. So that just compares them all side by side. So as I mentioned, I've circled there number 6, the NED plan is the one that has the most net benefits. So that's that 2.1 million total net benefit there. The key question for us is, do we expect these numbers to change a lot on further refinement, which would change our TSP selection? Or do the other criteria in those other three accounts besides the NED change the TSP selection? And from our looking at the various other criteria in the other accounts, the short answer is no, we don't expect that those would change the selection at this point in time. They all look to be fairly equal across the alternatives. So we really are relying on the numbers. So this is the slide that we would present to the Corps of Engineers leadership on TSP selection, and include that important component of the sponsor viewpoint. So we would invite someone from the city, likely Sinan Alpaslan, to speak to what the city's view is on the study at this stage. So if we do select the TSP as the NED plan, that's the most straightforward way forward from the Corps of Engineers leadership's point of view, because it's based on the highest net benefit or the greatest national benefit, then that's what we would put there, that's in red. And then to give you an idea of the path forward after the TSP milestone, we would work to optimize the design level, the aggregation level, how many structures would be included going forward in the analysis. And then very importantly, actually, this second bullet point here, looking into combining with detention basins if appropriate. So we understand that the detention basins are a very positive measure on their own. They have, as a separable element, they have their own high net benefits and a high benefit to cost ratio. We think that there is a high likelihood that they, in combination with some of the non-structural measures, would maybe be the NED plan itself. And so that would be a good path forward for us to evaluate next, and hopefully looking to do that in the next couple of weeks to get an answer on whether the numbers would support that, but looking optimistic. We would also refine the non-structural measures in the next stage. So really trying to get good answers on what floodproofing types would be applied to which structures and which would be suitable for elevation. And we'd also make sure to discuss key information and concerns about the non-structural measures with the sponsor, the city, and with the public, because we'd be getting ready at that point to move forward to the draft report and to the public meeting and all those levels of review that would come after that. Okay, and I'm going fairly quickly at the end here to get to the questions. I will pause here. I will mention again that Mr. Matt Jones is the project manager, so he or any of the other deep bench of folks here are on call to answer your questions and get your feedback on what has been presented here today. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Janet. If you could now move your screen back from sharing, that would be helpful. Thank you. On behalf of my colleagues, we thank you folks for joining us this evening and for the information that you have presented. Mr. Rose, unless you have comments that you are or staff would like to make, I assume we'll be opening this up for questions from my colleagues.
Mayor,
who would like to begin? It's a quiet group, or my screen has frozen.
I can still hear you.
Are there questions from members of council? Mr. Kusick.
Thank you, Mayor. I have a couple of questions. I guess, Janet, on page, 17 of the presentation, which shows the possible 500 residential structures in the 25-year plan. What are those 500 structures based on?
Yeah, so those 500 are the structures that are in the 25-year floodplain that experienced any flood damage. So that is to say, the flood depth grids that we got from the HMH modeling went above the base of the structure.
And then were you able to compare those findings with what the actual historical data shows from the different flood events that have taken place in University City?
Yeah, I appreciate that question. And so fortunately, since you asked that, last Monday, we sort of went around the horn and tried to get a better answer. So the way that we model flood depth and flood risk to get an idea of historic damages is really more based on the H&H modeling that takes the historic storms into account in the calibration stage and looking at getting the flood depths right. And then applying that to the national structure inventory, the inventory of, you know, buildings and how high they are. And so that's what is what is the Corps of Engineers methodology across the organization nationwide. And it is done that way so that our leadership can address or compare projects across the country sort of on an equal footing. We did also look into what information FEMA had available. We were on a call with FEMA earlier today, as I mentioned, or SEMA, excuse me. And we asked, you know, about the availability of flood data and if this was something that FEMA can provide. And her answer, this is Ms. Karen McHugh earlier today, she said that that is very unusual for FEMA to give out data, even to them, the state agency, and even to us, the federal government as well. It is a very sort of difficult, onerous process that takes about 6 months or more to get hold of the data. And it's just not typically something that's used in planning. So that was interesting information for us. But does that answer your question, or do you have any other thoughts on that?
It does, and it beggars the larger question that if you're using this national modeling, are you doing this because you don't have data when we actually do have some data? The reason I ask this is some of the inundation modeling that you presented to the commissioners for the stormwater issues, your inundation modeling for 2008 for a flood that actually took place shows that flooding did not occur in areas that we know for a fact that did flood. Areas around Mona and Groby Road, Hafner Court Apartments, and some other areas. So your inundation modeling does not show what the historical event shows.
Okay. Yeah, I am glad that you're mentioning this. We have not been made aware of those discrepancies yet. But if you would like to share that information, that's definitely something we'd like to see. And CNON did make us aware that the commission was working on getting those. I believe it was based on maximum flood lines. Was that correct from photography from that event? Is that what the data is that you have?
Yes, and measurements, actual measurements that the commissioners have taken. Excuse my lights. Measurements that the commissioners have taken to show what the where the flooding was in those areas.
Okay, very good. Well, I might take this opportunity to phone a friend and ask our H&H engineer Joel if he has an additional response to that. Joel, are you on the line?
Yeah. Thank you, Jen. On the high water mark stuff, from what I did see in the report, there was a lot of information given about Mona, Wilson Avenue, Shaftesbury, that area in there. That's really where most of the flooding was with respect to River De Pere. Seeing specific high water mark information, we can take a look at it, but most of the calibration for the model was done based on that University City gauge at that footbridge in Heman Park. And really, I used two different storm events and I matched the results of the observations. And that's pretty much kind of how we do predictive modeling in a nutshell, is we go through and we look at the past events and see how they compare. And again, from that, then we go in and then we assess the damages at different levels. I can go in and look at things in finer detail, but you need to kind of keep in mind too what level of design this is. We're really at the 10% level this stage. So
then we will be able to look at those results that the commissioners have put together.
Sure, of course.
And then you were talking about the bridges, specifically Pennsylvania Vernon Bridge and the Mona Bridge. And I believe you may have said something, or someone from your team may have said something about the sizes of the bridges, and that our photographs and our evidence shows that those bridges are too small, and that it's the water that's going up and around those bridges and not allowing that water to go through. That once the water would reach the tunnels to where it's in the channel of the tunnel, which I believe is at the end, east end of Dartmouth, that there's not really a back problem there with the backflow, that the tunnels can handle it. And consequently, it's been questioned as to whether or not increasing the sizes of our bridges to handle increased flow would really affect anything downstream.
Yeah, that's definitely a big question mark there. You know, we stopped looking at the tubes, but the one thing that we can tell is that definitely with the widening, you are pushing more water downstream. And in terms of what would be an MSD's best interest, they really can't permit that because it in a way could force problems upon them, unforeseen ones.
Because of that issue be explored further, because the tubes, information seems to indicate that the tubes could handle that additional flow.
I can't speak for that to say. There's too many unknowns at this point. You're right, we could look more down the line at it. We do have information, but again, there's only so much we can do at this point with what we got.
So your inundation model shows approximately 500 residential structures, and it's difficult to read your map, but how many of those 500 structures would be above the 82nd Street mark, which would, I guess, be north and northwest above 82nd Street? And the 25-year assumptions show some of those homes flooded. Are you able to tell me that?
Yes, I would not be able to tell you that off the top of my head. I believe that Jordan Lucas, our economist, told me it was about 30 structures that were upstream of 82nd and I-170. But Jordan, if you're on the line, can you speak to that?
I'm not sure on the top of my head, but that's something I can turn up and get back to you.
Because the indications are, again, that there has not been flooding in those areas. We have no reports of any flooding. It would be interesting to talk to MSD and with FEMA to even ask them if there have been any claims in that area. Even Councilmember Smotherson, I've spoken with him about it, who's lived in the area for quite a number of years, has indicated that in his memory, there has never been a flood event that has affected the households above 82nd Street. And again, your inundation models show a significant overland flooding in those areas and affecting many of those properties, when in fact it may not be true. So would it be possible to look at those again?
Yes, I will say definitely the H&H portion. I'm seeing Sean lighting up, so I'll be quick, Sean, and then I'll pass to you. The inundation modeling, the H&H modeling, yes, if you're seeing that information mapped out, then yes, that is the best that we have based on that level of calibration that Joel was talking about. With the 25-year event, it's sort of in the name that it's a 4% likelihood of happening in any given year, which puts it at a 25-year frequency of happening. As we know, floods can come more frequently or less frequently than that. We sort of have to use the data available to get to which structures are flooding and how frequently. But that is interesting to know that those structures do not appear to have flooded as frequently. So I suppose I'll stop and pass over to Sean. Sean, did you want to say something?
Yeah, I think the only thing I was just wanting clarity on is that area upstream of the 82nd. Was that based on, Mr. Cusick, the 25-year flood event, or was that somehow mapped or identified, you know, through the flood insurance rate mapping? Over.
I do not know. I just know that we do not have any information that shows that there has been any flooding in that area. And we have no record of it from the 2008 flood. And I think that the the Howth and Spencer report of 71 did not indicate that there was flooding in that area in the two major floods that they studied, which I believe were from 69 and 1957.
And Joel, can you give just a reference to the 10-year flood event?
Let me see if I can explain it this way. Our predictive modeling, we calibrate the models based on observed events. Okay, I use NEXRAD precipitation, ran the model. When we do the frequency events, we're doing them based off of forecasted precipitation. Okay, so it's a statistical identified likelihood of precipitation. We take that, we put it in the model, that's what spits out the water surface. So just because it hasn't flooded before doesn't mean it doesn't have that flood potential. What we're showing is the 25-year level impact. What the 2008 event was a little bit below the 10-year. So you kind of see right now we're at a higher level than that. So, you know, really we're just in the beginning. If you do have additional information like high water marks, like I said, what we went with was what was in the Stormwater Commission's report. But if you guys do have that information, I'm more than willing to take that into account, take a closer look at it. But, you know, if you want to talk about specific structures, I don't know if you want to get into more detail on that.
Okay. Thank you for that. And I do have a couple more questions. And your benefit cost ratios and actually purchasing dwellings, and I believe you have budgeted $250 million for purchasing homes, which comes out to about $500,000 per home. Just as an aside, and keep in mind that when we did the Wilson buyouts in 2015 or 2014, we purchased 26 structures at a cost of only $4 million. So I think that there may be some structures that would have to be bought out because nothing can be done to floodproof them, and they just need to be bought out because of continual flooding. And again, our cost at that time for those properties was only approximately $160,000 to $180,000. And I'd also like to add that with some of those structures that have repetitive loss, those people may eventually be faced with FEMA sending them letters stating that their only option now is to go through a forced buyout because FEMA's not going to insure them any further because of the repetitive losses. And I would like to keep that on the on the agenda that there may be structures that would have to be bought out. Finally, I'd like to add that the floodproofing method of essentially the dry floodproofing method, where you have that as one of the top, I forgot what the word is, part of the TSP selection. The dry floodproofing, we would actually be asking residents to give up their basement and move their washer and dryer and furnace and stuff like that that's in the basement on the first floor. That's going to have a drastic effect on property values and living space for these homes. So we need to keep that in mind when we consider something like that, as well as there's still a question as to how much floodproofing methods like that will reduce the overall rates of insurance that people can pay through FEMA. So I would just like to point that out as well and make sure that that stays in the discussion. So I'm sorry I've manipulated all this time, but that's all the questions I have right now.
I know that Councilmember Smotherson has a question. I'm not sure who else. So, and I know
I
that
one question.
I beg your pardon?
I was just saying I have one question.
Okay. Well, Mr. Smotherson, Mr. Clay, and Mr. Rose, how's that? Mr. Smotherson?
Thank you, Mayor Crow. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I just wanted to ask a quick question, and Councilmember Cusick kind of led to that. One of the critical issues in the third ward is flood insurance. That is a huge issue. And I'm just wondering if Janet could answer, why is flood insurance only listed under one aspect of your options, and that is actually number six, and only to elevation, when in fact you have a benefit BCR under basin number four, detention basin number four, that's 2.98. Why does that not help in the issue of flood insurance? If you could explain.
Yes, great question. So I'll start with the FEMA premium reduction side of it. So unfortunately, I suppose, in our planning process on the Corps of Engineers side, flood insurance premium reduction through the National Flood Insurance Program is not considered a planning constraint. So the level of premium change to folks actually experiencing their premiums going up and down is not something that we look at. We look at flood damage and benefit overall. But that said, we know that it does impact people. It impacts the participation of people actually doing these measures. And of course, it impacts the narrative and then telling the story and getting people involved or rather into the program of making those changes. So it simultaneously is and is not part of the planning process in a frustrating way, in my opinion. But we definitely will be looking into the ramifications of the various floodproofing types and the elevation and acquisition. Those are actually, and I to speak a little bit further back to Mr. Cusick's question about wanting to keep acquisition in the mix for those repetitive loss structures, that is very much definitely still on the table as we move forward. So as I mentioned, this is a 10% level of design just to enable us to look between the alternatives and see which ones are doing well and which ones are not. So all of those things are still on the table as we move forward, as we refine and optimize in the analysis. So definitely the insurance part of the question will be something that we're keeping in mind. Although, as I said, we can't sort of necessarily make a planning decision just based on that impact to people's insurance premiums. And I apologize. Now I've talked so much about that side that I have not tracked the end of your question. Would you mind repeating the end of your question?
To my question?
Yes, I'm sorry. Yes.
I'm sorry. No. I think you've answered my question. But the point to my question is this, is that, you know, I lived in the floodplain for years. And there was an event that changed that. Now, detention basin might be something to consider, but something happened and that changed that floodplain area for me, because we were paying almost $2,000 a year for flood insurance. And so that's why it's critical. It is, even though we're doing this, flood insurance is a critical aspect of this, because what we do will have an effect on that, and and that's important for people to know. And that ends my question. Thank you,
Mr. Clay.
Thank you, Mayor Crow. Thank you, Ms. Buchanan, to you and your team for the presentation. I actually wanted to double click on a question that my colleague, Councilmember Cusick, had regarding the loss of basements. that struck me. So people would, and even though they may be having some issues with wetness now, they would actually lose their basement. Would there be any compensatory space added, or they would just lose the basement and that would kind of be it?
Yeah, so the short answer is yes, in most cases, losing the basement is what would get to that full level of benefit. So if it's not usable anymore, then it's not subject to damage anymore. And so that's where the benefit comes, and that's where the loss to any items in the basement or the loss of structural integrity in the basement. That's where that benefit comes in. But I'll put a big star asterisk next to that and say that this is something that would still need to be refined, and it is possible that there will be some structures that would get to keep a basement and still have that modification, most likely still raise the utilities, and that could be still within the basement, but just higher off the ground in the basement. There are still some design questions that would need to be answered, and also some questions about the actual structures themselves. And I would also want to pass that question off to, let's say, Jordan Lucas, the economist who's been looking at that level of analysis and has been with us on those calls. So Jordan, do you have any additional answers to that question?
No, I think you pretty well hit the nail on the head that, you know, really there are, when it comes to non-structural measures, there are a lot of different things you can do to a structure. Several of those do, in fact, require you to fill the subfloor or the basement. And, you know, that is, you know, as I can't remember, Janet, if you mentioned it or not, we, you know, you asked, are they compensated in any way? And the answer to that is, unfortunately, no, they're not. They just lose their basement, and it's an unfortunate side effect of that measure.
Thank you.
I apologize that I continue to have technical difficulties here at home. I think, Mr. Rose, you're up next.
Just very quickly, I just want clarification that at this point you're leaning towards a combination of detention basins as well as floodproofing. Is that accurate?
Yes, that is accurate. And I apologize to all on the call that it's a little bit confusing with the final array being what it is, and the final number six non-structural just says floodproofing and elevation. But we are really moving forward to the next stage, planning to bring in those detention basins as a combined alternative. So once we get past that TSP milestone, yes.
So an add-on to that, I noticed that no detention basin is actually within University City, and that approval is needed from the municipalities within which the detention basins are. Is there a reason that you did not look at University City for the construction of a detention basin?
Well, one of the two is within University City. Okay. Detention Basin 3 is located directly adjacent to Olive Boulevard and the River de Pere. But yes, the other one, Detention Basin 4, that's just upstream of I-170 in the city of Overland. The rationale for looking at those was that those two sites were the most hydraulically feasible, so they held the most water far enough upstream to have that benefit to the flood levels downstream.
So if I'm just playing devil's advocate here, the city of Overland decides that for whatever reason they don't want a detention basin there, does that then impact the effectiveness of the system that you're creating? Or would you simply include an additional detention basin in University City?
Well, that's a great question. I think that as we move forward, we'll be combining Detention Basin 3 and 4 with the non-structural in different ways to find the combination that has the highest net benefits. If the city of Overland does not support putting a detention basin there in that park location, after coordination, so the next step is coordinating with them and gauging their level of interest and support. But yes, if that's the case, then we still have Detention Basin 3, and we know that on its own, that does provide benefit too. So that would still be a piece of the puzzle that we could use.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So my quick question is, Overland has not been engaged in it this time at all.
That is correct, yes. We talked about engaging them, but it just took until really the last couple of weeks or last week to be sure that the detention basins would be sort of the number two in the list of preferred alternatives. So Now that we know that we're interested in carrying that forward and investigating further, yes, definitely coordination is needed as a next step.
And just briefly, do they have the same flooding issues as us or not necessarily?
I don't know that they have flooding issues in the upper River De Pere. I think it's such a low flow in the streams that are in that area. They might have flooding on the other side, you know, going to other tributaries that we're not aware of, but right. Their level of participation from their flooding, they're not going to be thinking, we have a flooding problem.
I think their level of interest may be a little, maybe waning. As we round out, we have 4 minutes left. Are there any questions or comments to be made prior to moving into the regular session? Mr. McMahon.
I just had one question. Quick.
That's not my computer.
My understanding on the plan, the number 6, that the benefits are the elimination of the benefits, essentially. Can you hear me, Terry?
We can now, yes.
Okay. So is my understanding that the elimination of the benefits result in the basements result in the $2 million annual benefits in plan number 6?
Janet. Yes, I'm sorry. I was on mute. So the flood proofing, all those dots, the large majority of the 500 that was in this analysis, those would include a variety of flood proofing, sort of a TBD. Some of them, yes, likely to include losing basements, but unfortunately, we're not yet at that level of detail to know which ones.
Okay, but you're premising that on 100% participation, and if you don't get that, I mean, if we only get 50% participation, you're down to $1 million in benefits, which you're below the second. So now you're down to second highest. And that's one of the risks of this is participation. So isn't that kind of an inflated? I mean, to make that the highest, you had to assume 100% participation.
I hear where your question is coming from, and that's a great question. So yes, so the way that we approach it is absolutely we don't expect 100% participation in the next or when this is rolled out. Let's say it's really just a tool for analysis. We will be doing in the next phase a participation survey that looks specifically at, you know, what the expected actual participation would be. But we did have our economists and other economists in the division look at what would the range be. So what if we had really low participation? Would that change our final number? Would that change our TSP selection? And maybe I'll let Jordan speak to that. But the answer came back that generally, no, it would not. It would still come out on top with the most benefit. So I guess, Jordan, do you want to jump in there and speak to that?
Yeah, so basically what happens is post-TSP, we will do a sensitivity analysis. And so we'll look at that and we'll probably look at 25%, 50%, and 75% participation. We'll provide the estimate of net benefits for each of those. And, you know, that's when we sit down and we look at it together and we say, okay, look, if there's 75% participation, then it still has the most net benefits. If there's 50% participation, it's pretty close to the same amount of net benefits as, you know, one of the detention basins. And if it's 25% participation, it's no longer, you know, it has negative net benefits. And I'm making numbers up.
Right, I get that.
And
Thank you.
So then at that point, we'll sit down and if it, you know, maybe, you know, we'll say, oh, at the 50% participation, it still provides the most net benefits. So we'll drill down on that and, you know, it'll be part of our analysis and we'll say, look, there's a lot of risk to this. You know, if we see just a 75% participation rate, then it no longer looks like it would be justified. Then obviously we would pivot from that being sort of our focus of the arrays. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think then it also makes sense in trying to combine even the one detention basin at a cost of $9 million, because that would hedge your bets against participation, because you're getting $1.2 million in benefits right there. So that really, that combination seems to make a lot of sense, just from my maybe uneducated guess. But thank you.
No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And you know, one thing that happens is you put that detention basin in and it lowers stage for everybody. And so then including non-structural measures is actually less expensive, and you're able to, you know, remove the damages to structures for a lower cost when you use non-structural in conjunction with the detention basin. So you're right on track with that. That's, you know, that's something that's very common whenever you, when you combine a structural measure with non-structural component as well.
Thank you.
Well, to everyone, we are running a little bit late for our regular session to begin at 6:30. I am assuming I don't see any other hands up that are requesting to ask questions. So to our team here that have presented this information and answered our questions, we thank you very much for joining us tonight, Janet in particular, for carrying most of the water. So to all of you, thank you very much. We look forward to working with you as we move forward. To my colleagues, unless someone tells me they have to, we are going to end this session and begin the regular session immediately. Thank you very much.